welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 46, Pell's Point. I am very sorry for the Wednesday edition. I forgot my computer at work yesterday, so unfortunately, I got home, was getting ready to record the podcast, and realized that I had forgotten a key piece of equipment, my computer. But here we are, a day late, but not a dollar short on information. Last two episodes, we were talking about the situation on Manhattan. First, we talked about Harlem Heights, the battle that really showed how that the Americans could put up a good fight. Not just put up a fight, put up a good fight. And then we continued on to talk about this really bad week he had with the New York fire. Well, now we're going to head into Pell's Point. It's now October, and the two armies have just been staring at each other for the better part of 4 weeks. And once again, Henry Clinton is angry at Howe. Surprise, surprise. It's all due to his inactivity. You see, Howe was receiving word from the North. The Northern Army under Sir Guy Carleton and General John Burgoyne were moving south from Canada towards Albany. The problem is that this report gives a rather over-optimistic view of the situation. You see, it leads Howe to believe that Burgoyne and Carleton are much closer to Albany than they really are. And if you couple that information with the fact that he was waiting on another 8,000 Hessians to arrive from Europe, well, he was just going to sit around and wait for those two events to happen. What actually is the fact is the British Army are engaged in the Battle of Valcour Island up in the north, and they're nowhere near Albany. And so he's just going to wait for his reinforcements, and he's going to eventually have to make a move. But the British Northern Army is no closer to Albany than Howe is. Washington, on the other hand, has had a very productive 4 weeks. He has shored up his position at Harlem Heights. He now controls King's Bridge on both sides of the Harlem River, along with Forts Lee and Washington on either side of the Hudson. Well, this is a strong position, and it's been proven that to break the line at Harlem Heights was going to be extremely difficult. So once again, Clinton proposes a plan to kind of do this end around of Washington's army. The best case they could hope for is that they're going to trap Washington and the army in its place, cut off their lines of communication, and then force them to fight on British terms. Well, the first step was going to be to land troops up at New Rochelle. This is going to be well north of Kingsbridge. From there, they would move to block the roads from the city, stopping all communication with Washington's army. This would force Washington into a fight-or-flight scenario. If he has to fight, he's going to fight on British terms. They have chosen the place, the time, and all the variables in the battle. So he's really going to have to fight their fight. And if you're fighting on British terms, the odds are never in your favor. Or his other option would be to flee New York altogether. And in doing so, would also work for the British because then they would have 100% full control of one of the Northern Colony's largest cities and definitely its largest port. It would also have access to the Hudson River, where they could move up to Albany and cut the New England colonies from the rest of the colonies, which was a scenario that they had been playing with since the beginning of the war. So both options are perfect for the British. And General Howe likes the plan. His brother, on the other hand, likes it, but has a counter to Clinton's plan. You see, Admiral Howe was a little hesitant to take his fleet that far north into New York. He offered a spot that was a little bit closer to Manhattan and suggested landing at Throg's Neck instead. And unfortunately for Clinton, he is overshadowed by the brothers Howe once again. So General Howe planned to leave Lord Percy in front of the Continentals at Harlem Heights to keep their attention. He didn't want to alert Washington to anything that was going on. And at 3 a.m. on the morning of October 12th, he would line up his army at Kipps Bay and load them onto the ships. And in total, this was going to be about 14,000 men. By sunrise, the fleet is underway. Clinton is standing aboard his ship and is just stewing over the events that have just happened. Once again, another plan is proposed by him, and Howe turns it down. What has happened to all the other plans that Clinton has put forward. Of course, they get turned down. Somehow, Washington escapes. Or Washington is able to see through their plan and beats them. Or it gives him a lot of time to shore up more men, more provisions, better defenses. If I was Howe, I would definitely be stewing over this fact. I have defended General Howe many a time, trying to let people know that when you listen to what I'm talking about, it's hard to just imagine what it would be like to face this man. He was one of the best generals that the British Army had. Now, you can imagine the way we've been talking that General Howe seems to be one of the most incompetent generals that they have. And that's not the case. Remember, history is written by the victors, and a lot of people who write about the American Revolution are Americans. So it's not surprising that we may illustrate some of the low points of General Howe. And that is kind of the fault of us as historians, but it is up to the reader's interpretation. And if you want to interpret what I'm saying is Howe was a terrible commander, that is fine. But given his track record in the previous conflicts on the European continent, he was one of the best generals the British had. He was aggressive. He came up with these outrageous plans that you would never think would work, but worked. Now he gets here and he's very hesitant to face off with Washington. He's very hesitant to execute a British style of fight against the Americans. And so if I was Clinton, I would definitely be frustrated because you know the reputation of General Howe. And unfortunately, it's just not there. And now, to make matters worse, he has been overshadowed by Admiral Howe, General Howe's older brother. And his plan once again has been altered. So the frustration level with Clinton must be through the roof at this point. I will say that on this short boat ride up to Throg's Neck, he gains a lot of respect for Admiral Howe as a seaman. On the morning of October 12th, the route they take is up the Harlem River through a portion that is called Hell's Gate. This area is known for its rocks, whirlpools, and other water hazards. Not to mention the fact that on the morning of October 12th, there was an incredibly dense fog that blanketed the area. So not only does he have to contend with all the hazards in the water, now he's contending with the fog. And Admiral Howe leads his fleet like a true British sailor. He gets his fleet through there with no issues whatsoever. The fog actually plays a key role for the British because the Continentals had no idea the fleet was moving. Local fishermen had no idea the fleet was moving until it passed them by. And they were shocked because they're afraid to take schooners into Hell's Gate. The British are sailing frigates and warships. Needless to say, it doesn't take long for Washington to gain word that a British fleet has just sailed up the Harlem River through Hell's Gate and is going towards Throg's Neck. Washington starts to get his men in motion. He knows a fight is coming. The Throg's Neck Peninsula in 1776 looks nothing like it does today. It jutted out into the Long Island Sound, and at high tide, it basically turned into an island because the marshlands that were at the north end of the peninsula filled up with water. So at any given time, the two best places to cross the peninsula into mainland New York would be from a bridge at one end of the peninsula or a ford at the other. General Heath, who is the commander of the troops in the area, 10 days prior to the British setting sail from Kips Bay, saw the peninsula as a possible landing zone. He orders Colonel Hand to dispatch 25 men and an officer to the bridge. They were going to set up on the Westchester side at a mill. The mill was close to the bridge and had a large woodpile that would make a perfect place to post riflemen. These men were just going to serve as an early warning system. You see, he wanted the riflemen to keep the British occupied just long enough for two things to happen. One, the boards of the bridge could be pulled up so they couldn't cross it. Two, giving him time to dispatch men to answer the threat. He also set up a similar type of post at the opposite end of the marsh at the ford as well. And so on the morning of October 12th, the British land at Throg's Neck. They unload their men, and they start to head for both crossing points. They figure if they split their force, they could take advantage of both crossing points that will get them over the marsh quickly and onto the mainland of New York. Unfortunately, when the lead elements get to the bridge, they notice that the boards have been pulled up and almost immediately come under fire from the riflemen behind the woodpile. A brief fire is exchanged, but the British are forced to retreat. There's nothing they can really do. They can't get over a bridge with no boards, and the riflemen are keeping a steady fire up. Why would you stand there and just let your troops get shot at? So they pull back. And the same thing happens at the ford. When we look at the New York campaign, the Americans excelled at using their positions to their advantage. This area was littered with stone walls, fences, bridges, fords, anything that they could use to take advantage. And Heath moved his 1,800 men quickly to the neck with artillery at the request of Washington. He said Heath had sent word to Washington immediately after he found out that the British had landed, and Washington ordered him to dispatch as many troops as he could spare to that location, and if need be, he would send more troops as well. Hal, however, does nothing but set up camp. You know, you would think that, well, if I can't get across a bridge with no boards or a ford, and the Americans are moving more troops to my position, why don't I just reboard my ships and land somewhere else? Instead, Hal waits for several more days for supplies to come from the city. Again, delays gave Washington all the time in the world to better his position. In the couple of days that Howe is sitting waiting at Throg's Neck, Washington has a couple of major changes to his army. He is going to reorganize the army into seven divisions. Lee, recently back from the south, takes over one division. Green takes over another. Heath obviously had one. Sullivan, who was recently exchanged in a prisoner exchange with Sterling, takes over another. Putnam had one, Spencer and Benjamin Lincoln had the seventh. Washington, with this embarrassment of riches when it came to division commanders, asked Lee of his advice. Lee was probably one of the most well-decorated soldiers in the entire American army, having served in the British army for so many years. And Lee thought that the army should retreat to White Plains. Washington was still in a position that he could be surrounded. At White Plains, the army would have a strong position that they could fortify, and Governor Trumbull of Connecticut had used White Plains as a supply depot, giving the Continentals access to provisions and ammo. And Washington agreed, thinking that this would be the better plan. However, General Greene, who's in command of Forts Lee and Washington, thought that the forts should be maintained. He was not ready to abandon Fort Washington. He felt that it would be useful to have a foothold in case the American army tried to retake the city. The fort also protected the Hudson from ships that could go north towards Albany. So Washington agrees, and Fort Washington would remain garrisoned. However, the rest of the army would march north towards White Plains. After several days of sitting at Throg's Neck, Hal finally has his men re-embark on the ships, and they're going to plan to make another landing farther to the east at Pelham Bay. Pelham Bay was a much better position, and had they landed there several days ago, they may have caught the Continentals off guard. The only Continental presence in the area was a small brigade under Colonel John Glover. He had about 750 men and three field pieces. On the morning of October 18th, the British ships sailed into Pelham Bay, and Howe began to offload his men. The first division to be offloaded was Henry Clinton's. He had about 4,000 men. They would be the advance force of the British Army as they marched up towards the American position. Glover readies his men and artillery and moves to intercept. So we've talked about how the Americans use all their positions to their advantage. And Pelham Bay area is no different than anywhere else that we've seen in Manhattan Island, in that it is littered with stone walls. They're everywhere. They border all the roads. They crisscross all the fields. So Glover is going to use this to his advantage. He knows that Clinton can't move his large column of troops quickly along this position. So he takes his four smallest regiments. He puts them in the field along the road towards Pell's Point. What he's planning to do is he's going to have, when the column approaches, one unit will attack. They will then displace and move to a new location. While they're moving, a second unit will attack. And then a third and a fourth. What actually happens to the British is a lot like what happened on the road from Concord back to Boston. They get leapfrogged. So when one unit attacks, it attacks and then displaces, and the next unit immediately picks up the attack. And he put them on alternating sides of the road because it would keep the British guessing where is the next attack going to come from. This way, they could leapfrog them all the way back to the Hutchison Creek, where Glover left his largest regiment and artillery, and he had plans to pull up the boards of the bridge so that once his ambushers escaped, then the British would be stuck once again on the opposite side of a creek with no way to cross it, at least unless they were going to build another bridge. So as Glover is placing his men, he receives word that the advance guard of the British Army is approaching. Glover sent a small detachment to occupy the advance guard, so they don't know what Glover is planning. The Americans get the drop on the advanced British units, but it doesn't take long for Clinton to move his men towards the sounds of the fighting. But Glover is ready for him, and Clinton's men marched right into the ambush. This leapfrog kept up the pressure on Clinton's forces. They were pouring tons of lead into the slow-moving British column. Glover's plan was working, but remember, he was outnumbered 6-1, and Clinton's men were still moving down the road. And as they inched ever closer to the Hutchison Creek, Glover ordered the ambush to cease and for his regiments to fall back behind his reserve regiment and the artillery on the other side, and then had the boards pulled up. With Glover's brigade on the other side of the creek and no way to cross it because the bridge had been knocked out, Clinton pulls his men just out of range of Continental artillery. The Battle of Pell's Point is not a huge engagement, but it had huge consequences for the New York campaign. This was a big deal. Once again, the British were blocked by a small American force. The tactical leapfrog game that Glover played with Clinton really kept the British on their toes. They had no idea where the next attack was coming from, and he was able to inflict a decent amount of casualties on Clinton's sizable force. Now, the fighting itself lasted only for a couple of hours. As you can imagine, it doesn't take long for a British force to march quickly to their target destination when they're being shot at, and the Americans were running and gunning the entire way. By the numbers, Glover reports that he had 8 men killed and 13 wounded. While the British, they claim to have 3 killed and 20 wounded. It's actually the Hessian numbers that are the most significant. They are also the most varying. They say anywhere from 200 to 1,000. Why is this number so high? Well, first is that 3/4 of Clinton's advance force were Hessians. So he had about 3,000 Hessians in his division of about 4,000. So I'm not really surprised that they had higher amount of casualties than the British. Second, once again, there is this political back and forth with underreporting and overreporting numbers to make one side, make both sides look better. Because if you really got thrashed, you want to lower your number so it wasn't so bad. But if you got a victory, you want to kind of up it to be like, this is how many we got. It was this many. No, it was this many that we got. So for me, whenever I read the varying numbers, at least with a spread that big, I always figure that with 200, it's an oversighted number for the Hessians because they don't want it to look so bad on their part, while 1,000 is an overestimation on the American side because they want to make it look better. 700, or not even 700 men, 400 men stopped 1,000 Germans. Whoa. So if you're going to make an educated assumption from the numbers that you're getting, I always say let's head to the middle because that's going to be your most accurate area. And the accurate area would be about 600 casualties, and that's my thought. But the history books write 200 to 1,000, so that's what we're going to report. Either way, Clinton's column is now stalled at Hutchison Creek. Glover, that night, will take his men to Dobbs Ferry on the Hudson. And once again, a small British force has held General Howe's larger army in check. The Battle of Pell's Point, its far-reaching consequence was not that Glover took out 1,000 British and Hessian soldiers. The key thing is that it won Washington the race to White Plains. Washington, on the 18th, was not fully as prepared as he should have been to get his army moved to White Plains. And if they got to Pell's Point, got over the Hutchison Creek, and got to a good bit of ground where they could move to halt Washington's advance towards White Plains, they could catch Washington and the army out in the open, or at least a portion of it. This gave Washington the ample amount of time he needed to get his men up to White Plains to set up their new defensive position. So that's going to do it for this week. I apologize for the Wednesday submission, but you guys know me, my busy work schedule, I post new episodes weekly, but they're always infrequent on the day of the week that I'm able to do it. Next week, there will be a new episode, and we will be talking about the battle at White Plains. We are inching ever closer to the end of the New York campaign, and I actually, after White Plains, we're just going to talk about Fort Washington, and we're going to talk about where Washington will end up in New Jersey, and then we're going to stop there. And then I'm trying to decide, and I'm actually going to put this poll out on the Facebook, but if you guys want to send me a private message on Facebook, or I'm going to try and set up a poll on Facebook, I don't know where the next place I want to go is. We have just finished up a campaign, and a rather long campaign at that, with a lot of things happening. We're not going to stay with Washington's army. We are now inching closer to 1777. I want to finish up 1776 because there is an entire portion of the country we have not talked about yet, and that's the Northern Campaign. We left off with the we ended the Canada campaign with the American Army pulling back to Crown Point. We then stopped there and did not continue talking about what was going on up there. And then we moved to work with Washington's army. So we can go up north and talk about the Northern Army, or I was going to set up a series of episodes talking about why the Hudson River is so important and what steps the Continental Army will take throughout the war years to halt the British from getting too far north up the Hudson into the Highlands and into Albany where they could really be effective. So I'm going to set up a poll on Facebook and kind of ask where you guys want to go next. Do we want to talk about a whole new set of a campaign, or do we want to talk about a set of side stories, like kind of like what we did with the South? It wasn't a full Southern campaign. It was kind of like, oh, this was happening, and then this happened here, that kind of thing. So I'm going to put the post up after I post this episode onto Libsyn, and you guys let me know. Everyone have a great week, and as always, keep that powder dry.